Okay, the Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Riley, Judge Cochran, Judge Rodenberg, the Honorable Denise D. Riley presiding.
Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. I'm sorry for the glitch getting the right Zoom link out, but I see that the attorneys are here and ready to proceed, I assume. This is being recorded and will be posted on our court website within a day or two. And welcome once again. When you begin your argument, please state your name for the record and the party that you're representing. You'll each have 15 minutes. Can you see the clock in the corner? At least it's in my corner. And then 5 minutes for rebuttal for appellant if you choose to use it. And with that, Mr. Giesen, are you ready to begin?
Yes, I am, Your Honor.
You may then.
May it please the court and counsel, my name is John Giesen. I represent the appellants, John Cruz and David Gosch, in this matter. The appellants are asking for reversal of two post-remand orders. The first is the denial of appellant's settlement enforcement motion, and the second is the grant of respondent Cheryl Orcutt's motion to amend the judgment. And I want to start first with the settlement enforcement issue, as I believe that's a threshold issue and may make the second issue irrelevant. We're asking this court to reverse the denial of our settlement enforcement motion because Cheryl Orcutt's discharge obligation is clear and unambiguous. The dispositive language is found in paragraph B2. As we've briefed, paragraph B2 states that Orcutt must discharge appellants from any judgment by the conclusion of the proceedings against any other insurer or March 1st, 2020, whichever comes first. This language is clear and unambiguous. Whichever comes first means what it says. It's undisputed that March 1st, 2020 has come and gone. It is also undisputed that the $700,000 judgment remains docketed against our clients. So there's no material dispute of fact. The discharge timing language is clear and unambiguous. It should have been summarily enforced. I want to talk first about Orcutt's interpretation, and we don't believe that's a second reasonable interpretation sufficient for creation of an ambiguity because it simply ignores whichever comes first. As we noted in our brief, at both the district court and in this court, Orcutt's brief is totally silent on whichever comes first. In fact, those words aren't even mentioned. Deliberate non-analysis is not a reasonable way to interpret a contract. In other words, it's not a second reasonable interpretation that would create an ambiguity. Next, I want to talk about the two interpretations or the reasons for ambiguity cited by the district court. We don't believe either of those reasons are persuasive either. The overarching reason cited by the district court was an interpretation of Drake v. Ryan as somehow dictating the result in this case. We don't believe that's the appropriate analysis. I think we're simply asking for basic contract interpretation principles to apply.
Why don't you think that's the appropriate analysis since the settlement agreement itself calls it a Drake Ryan settlement?
That is true, and it's right in the title. It says satisfaction of future judgment, Drake versus Ryan release. I think the dispositive issue that we presented is totally different than the issue in Drake. Our issue is the timing of a discharge, and nothing in Drake has anything to do with whether a party can guarantee or promise a discharge or satisfaction of a judgment by a specific date. That's an issue that's unique to this case. It's unique to the language of this contract, and reading ambiguity or changing the words of this contract based on extrinsic considerations like other case law is not something that's typically done. So our position is that this case should rise and fall on its own facts, especially the words of this contract. And given that the dispositive discharge timing issue is not considered in Drake, we just don't think it's particularly helpful in deciding when Ms. Orcutt was required to discharge this judgment. And the second consideration cited by the district court was
Judge Cochran, were you asking a question?
Yeah, sorry, I was muted. Just quickly going back to your argument about discharge of the judgment. If we look at the language of paragraph 2B, it talks about to discharge and release David Gosch and John Cruz from any liability under the judgment. Would you agree that that discharge of liability is different than a discharge of a judgment? Isn't there a distinction there?
I think there's a distinction in words, but not a distinction in substance. We've cited Black's Law Dictionary. I think there was an attempt by respondent to make a similar argument that, you know, you can discharge a judgment or liability under judgment without satisfying it. You know, at least as I read Black's Law Dictionary, those words are synonymous. Discharging liability, releasing liability, and discharging the judgment, I think that's, different words, but not a different meaning. I think they mean equivalent things. To discharge liability under a judgment and discharge a judgment, I think, is equivalent.
You agree that no effort has been made by the plaintiffs below to collect from either of the individuals, correct?
That is correct. There's been no supersedious bond. There was a window from which garnishment proceedings or other enforcement action could have been taken. And it's not for me to say, I don't believe it's in the record, but there has been no efforts to collect.
Which is really the essence of a Drake Ryan arrangement. That is to say, as long as the individuals are not pursued or collection attempted as against them, that's really the purpose, right?
Generally, yes. I would agree with that. And I think that's spelled out in this settlement agreement, which again is titled Drake versus Ryland in the title. I just would be careful to distinguish that just because it's titled Drake versus Ryan release, that it dictates an outcome other than what the words say. So I think in general, that's correct. And Ms. Orcutt did have a substantial window of time to enforce that judgment. However, that window's now expired.
Her agreement, and as I understand it in the settlement agreement, is that she would not seek to satisfy the judgment from either of your clients, right?
Yes.
And then, she has not breached that part of her agreement, right?
Correct.
I'm confused about that she had a window within which she could have enforced it. It seems like the judgment in this case didn't become final until, I don't know, sometime like September of 2021 or something like that, right?
Yeah, and I think the history here, there is a bit of a tortured procedural history. The actual judgment, if you look on Vinsys or Odyssey, it's entered June of 2019. So there was some errors, some clerical errors that prevented ultimately there being a judgment. But the judgment was actually entered in June of 2019.
Right. But it didn't really become final, and prejudgment interest, we'll talk about that perhaps in a moment, but it wasn't final and appealable until sometime in late 2021, right?
Yes, agree with that. I think there was some issues prior. I mean, I'll get into this with the jurisdictional argument that's been raised, that somehow we should have raised this issue previously. The judgment did not award damages. So, I mean, there's various orders this court has issued, but originally the judgment did not award damages. It was not final. So that prevented the original appeal from going forward. Ultimately, that's not my client's fault. Our clients were not the ones submitting proposed orders to the court, which the court followed. That's Ms. Orcutt's responsibility for not getting the judgment finalized. That could have been done and should have been done to give her a substantial window. So, yes, there has been some clerical errors that prevented entry of a final valid final judgment until after March 2020 or sometime around then. I have to look at my brief. I know we set it out in detail there. But had this been done appropriately, she would have had the default judgment back in 2019. So getting back to our interpretation and the district court's interpretation, I think one of the other issues that's been raised is paragraph C4, and somehow that has created ambiguity in the text of B2. And we just don't see that. I think these paragraphs can happily coexist. They address categorically different concepts. C4 says that Orcutt was not releasing any claim she has against any other insurer. C4 has nothing to do with the deadline of the discharge set out in detail in paragraph B2. C4 means that Ms. Orcutt can keep any indemnity claim she has, for example, against her own insurance carrier. It does not say that she can preserve a judgment against appellants indefinitely, despite her promise to discharge any judgment by March 1st, 2020 at the latest. Now, in short, there's no plausible, let alone reasonable way to interpret C4 as allowing Ms. Orcutt to keep this judgment docketed against my clients indefinitely. So we have not heard.
Isn't it plausible, counsel, to interpret B2 and C4 together to say that B2 releases your clients from any personal liability, but doesn't preclude recovery from an excess insurer?
I think that would read out the discharge obligation altogether. Again, you know, if you want to look at surrounding contract text, look at the title of this agreement. It's calling for a satisfaction of a future judgment. The judgment in this case has been docketed, and if that can remain indefinitely under C4, this entire agreement, paragraph B2 as a whole is rendered meaningless. And we don't believe that's a reasonable way to interpret B2. It would also be adding to what C4 says. C4 simply says she's not releasing claims against any other insurer. There's no insurer here asking for claims to be released. This is a motion by our clients simply to have the discharge promised in B2 enforced as written. So again, our primary position is that there is no second reasonable interpretation. Therefore, the language is unambiguous and the district court's ambiguity conclusion should be reversed. But even if this court were to confirm that the district court's ambiguity conclusion were correct, that still requires reverse and remand. That's because summary fact-finding is inappropriate in a summary judgment motion, and the Supreme Court's voice stream decision makes clear that a motion to enforce a settlement should be resolved as if it were a summary judgment motion. So even if this court were to agree with the district court's interpretation and find that this language, this conflict between B2 and C4 creates an ambiguity, still, a reverse and remand is required so that this ambiguity can be resolved by the appropriate fact finder. And just to touch lightly on the jurisdictional argument, I'm sure I may have more to say in rebuttal, but we just don't think the timeline lines up that this issue was somehow previously ripe for review in our appeal from the denial of our motion to vacate. Again, the judgment here was entered in June of 2019. We moved to vacate in July of 2019, and then the order denying that motion to vacate was then issued in December of 2019. Again, this is all happening before the discharge promised, that promise to discharge the judgment was breached. We had no way of raising that as part of our prior motion to vacate the judgment. And in fact, once we did finally perfect an appeal from that judgment and order denying our motion to vacate, we had no way of getting that issue heard because we attempted to do so in district court and couldn't get a hearing, and then attempted to, after perfecting our appeal, tried to get this court to stay the district court proceeding so that we could raise it. In short, we couldn't get heard by any court. And I don't think that's the purpose or intent of this finality of appeals doctrine, to bar you from raising an after-acquired claim that no court would previously hear. In short, the issue was not previously ripe for appellate review because it had never been previously considered or decided, and therefore it's properly raised at this time and may be decided by this court. And in the couple minutes I have left, I just want to touch briefly on our alternative argument. Again, we don't think the grant of the motion to amend the judgment is necessary to consider if the judgment is vacated, but if this court does affirm that first issue, then it should look at this motion to amend the judgment coming after the last remand. Our basic argument is that if, yes, the statute allows prejudgment interest, but that doesn't mean that you can simply move for prejudgment interest and get tens of thousands of more dollars after the defaulting parties appear. Any right can be waived, even constitutional rights.
Do you have any case law? Excuse me, Mr. Giesen. Do you have any case law for your proposition that the prevailing plaintiff must affirmatively request the prejudgment interest? It seems that 549.09 subdivision 1 A and B, it shall be awarded. So I'm just wondering how you counter that shall in the statute.
I mean, that's saying that you do have a right to get that relief. But that doesn't mean that if you don't ask for it, the court needs to reach out and decide an issue that wasn't raised. And I think it goes back to basic part principles of party representation.
You know, but our clients may have claims. Case law that says that you have to request it to get it?
As case law, Minnesota case law is pretty sparse on that point, but there is persuasive federal authority we've cited, and the unanimous, or not unanimous, I think the weight, there is some case law on the other side, but I think the weight of authority is that you don't get claims or pre-written interest you didn't ask for. I think the burden is on you. You have the right to it under the statute. So if you don't ask for it, it's not up to the district court to award it anyways. You have to do that within the time for a post-trial motion. And that certainly didn't happen here.
To the point of waiver or forfeiture, let me just sort of assume for the purpose of the question that there is a possibility of waiver or forfeiture of the right to prejudgment interest. It doesn't seem like this is the case for that because, as you've discussed, we went through all this, judgments in different amounts and a previous appeal and a remand and findings. You know, it looks to me like it was sometime in September of 2021 that the court could even possibly have computed prejudgment interest on what ended up being the final amount.
I know my time's expired, but I'll just respond briefly. I would respectfully disagree. I think any of the four proposed orders submitted by respondent in this case could have addressed prejudgment interest. The number of days accrued, you calculate per diem interest and your amount accrued would be different. But the pre-verdict interest was not addressed in any of the four proposed orders submitted by respondent.
That gets to my question, though. Even if it had been, that would have been computed on a number that ultimately wouldn't have been the right number anyway, right?
Well, I think this court did say that the original number the district court found was incorrect, but that doesn't mean that you don't have to ask for pre-verdict interest. I mean, the district court should have awarded pre-verdict interest on the original 1.06 million that it awarded, and it could have done that. So, ultimately this court reversed that number, which is why we got to the remand, but then to have a second shot at actually a fifth cut at it, a proposed order after this court remanded, I think, is inconsistent with the rules of procedure and with that persuasive federal case law that we've cited. So with that, we'd ask the court to reverse the denial of our settlement enforcement motion or at minimum remand for fact finding, and also reverse the grant of the motion to amend the judgment, either to remand for a trial on the merits or at minimum vacate the $25,000 pre-verdict interest. Thank you.
Thank you. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Johnson?
Good morning, Your Honors and counsel. My name is Greg Johnson, and I represent the respondent, Cheryl Orcott, in this matter. We are asking the court to affirm the district court's orders of, I believe it was September 10th, 2021, which involved the Drake Ryan settlement agreement, and also the March 8th, 22 order, which involved the district court's award of prejudgment interest. I would like to address the Drake v. Ryan issue first, from both that fails on both substantive grounds and on procedural grounds. The district court decided the matter on substantive grounds and did not address the procedural jurisdictional aspects. So I'll address the substantive aspects first. This is a Drake v. Ryan settlement agreement, and the district court so concluded in its order, and it cannot be considered in a vacuum from Drake v. Ryan and the purpose of a Drake v. Ryan settlement agreement. But there's only really two key provisions in here that the court needs to look at and consider in affirming the district court's conclusion. The first is the release, the actual release language in B2, and the second is the preservation of claims against insurance carriers in Section C4. Those two provisions are not inconsistent, they're not ambiguous, And they are interpreted exactly as I believe it was Judge Cochran indicated. First, the release language does not release, quote, a judgment. It doesn't discharge a judgment. It doesn't extinguish a judgment or satisfy a judgment. What it does is it releases the individual tortfeasors, the appellants, from any liability they have to pay the judgment. And that's consistent, obviously, with the overall purpose of a Drake v. Ryan agreement, is to insulate the tortfeasor from any personal liability, any financial exposure for a potential future judgment. That is the critical point of the Drake v. Ryan cases. And so the Johnson, language, when you look at the,
So how do you respond to Mr. Giesen's argument about that date? That what are we supposed to do with the March 1, 2020 date that's in the agreement?
This agreement postponed the effective date of the release of personal liability, and it's undisputed that pursuant to the settlement agreement, the effective date was March 1, 2020. The judgment's issued in June 19, 2019, and then we have, after the judgment, we have the release of the appellants from personal liability. There's no dispute regarding the effective date. It is effective. That's the earlier of the two in B2. The question, the material issue, is not the timing of it. It's what is the legal effect of the actual release in B2. And B2, and I can explain later why an injured claimant would want, in some situations, to delay postponement of a personal release of liability of the tortfeasors to pay a judgment. And that relates to the unusual circumstance. It's very unusual, but it can occur where you find out after entering into a Drake v. Ryan that the tortfeasor's policy, their excess policy, turns out to be what is called as an indemnity against loss, aka reimbursement policy, as opposed to the typical personal auto policy, which are indemnity against liability policies. The distinction there is pretty critical, and it's this. It's that under an indemnity against liability policy, the typical policy that everybody runs into 99% of the time, the insurer's obligation to pay is triggered immediately upon entry of judgment. And secondly, the insurer has an obligation to pay that judgment directly to the injured claimant. And that's what we have in this case. In an indemnity against loss policy, reimbursement policy, and these were typical back in the early 1900s, but there's still some forms like this out there. The insurer has no obligation to pay anything until the insured, the tortfeasor, actually pays the judgment and then goes back after their own insurance company and request reimbursement of the policy. Now, if you have the personal liability release being effective immediately upon execution of the Drake v. Ryan release, as was the case in Drake v. Ryan, then you could run into complications down the road if it turns out that you're dealing with an indemnity against a loss type policy. And I'd like to, there's a few cases, this goes back to 1895, indemnity against loss policies in Minnesota. And they're also addressed in some of the cases that I cited in a footnote. I cited the Roney v. Caravan International Corp. case, that's a Kansas case, which sets forth the distinction between an indemnity against liability policy and an indemnity against loss policy. But in Minnesota, you can go back all the way to the Anoka Lumber Company case, which is 65 Northwest 353, 1895. That was the first case in Minnesota that addressed the distinction between those two types of policies. So that's the purpose of delaying it from the execution date, which in this case would have been February 2016, to a future date, is to enable, you know, in the unlikely event you have an indemnity against loss policy that comes into play. But in this particular case, we're not dealing with that. We're dealing with an effective date of March 1, 2020 that nobody disputes. Everybody knows that the appellants have no liability whatsoever to pay this. And in fact, even before March 1, 2020, the district court had issued an order back in June 19th, 2019, stating that the only recovery of this judgment could only be obtained against insurance proceeds, not against these individuals themselves. And so the real issue here is, the material issue is, what is the significance or what is the meaning of the language in B2, which releases, as Judge Cochran indicated, it releases them, quote, from liability under a judgment, close quote. It does not release the judgment itself. That's the purpose of B2, is to make clear that they're never going to have to pay it. Then you drop down to C4, and C4 specifically preserves the injured claimant's right to proceed on that judgment, to collect that judgment from any excess carrier that may insure the tortfeasors. And that's the essence of the holding by this court in Drake v. Ryan, and which was affirmed by the Supreme Court in Drake v. Ryan back in 1994. So those
The district court found the language in those provisions to be ambiguous, and then or in B2 to be ambiguous, and then then went on to find that read as a whole, the agreement. Well, actually, I guess both of them. Sorry. So the court finds that the agreement as a whole is susceptible to more than one reasonable interpretation. Do you agree that with the district court that the language is ambiguous?
No, not at all. The two sections are dovetail with each other. That was in B2. They deal with totally different things. One is the release of the tortfeasors from personal liability to pay a judgment. That's B2. And then section C4 is essentially incorporating the ultimate holding in Drake v. Ryan that a personal release of liability does not have any impact whatsoever on the injured claimant's right to A, pursue the tortfeasors to judgment, and B, if successful, and the amount of that judgment exceeds what you get from the primary carrier, in this case, $100,000, then you can commence an ancillary garnishment proceeding in order to collect that directly from the excess insurance carrier. So this is exactly the same situation you have in Drake v. Ryan. It's just Drake v. Ryan all over, except they don't analyze, the appellants don't spend any time even attempting to analyze Drake v. Ryan. So the provisions of the settlement agreement, the two specific ones, B2 and C4, are clear and unambiguous and apply to different things and are entirely consistent with Minnesota common law, including Drake v. Ryan, that we have the right, Cheryl Aircraft has the right, and will exercise the right if the court affirms the district court in this matter, to commence a garnishment proceeding against the insurer, Grinnell Mutual Reinsurance Company. Now, Grinnell has commenced a coverage action, so that's pending as well. But
Mr. Johnson, let's move on to the second argument.
Yes.
Mr. Neeson says you had at least five opportunities to request the pre-judgment interest. You didn't, and you shouldn't get it now. How do you respond to that?
Well, factually, that's correct, that there were several orders that were submitted that did not include pre-judgment interest. However, under case law and under the statute itself, an award of prejudgment interest is mandatory, and therefore its omission can be rectified at any time, either by the court sua sponte on its own initiative or by a party to correct the judgment to so reflect that. But factually, yes, it should, as a practice, it should have been done earlier. Now, this court.
Counsel, as I understand your argument, though, you're saying that it was proper to bring a motion under Rule 60.01, the argument in your brief, to correct the absence of that pre-judgment interest in the order. Appellants argue in their brief that Rule 60.01 does not apply because Rule 60.01 is not used to state something other than what was originally pronounced. So is it appropriate to rely on Rule 60.01?
I believe it is under several cases that we cited, including the Paulson case, other federal district court cases that have reached similar holdings in their cases. And the other aspect of this is, as Judge Rodenberg was saying, is that it's not like they had some expectation of an award of a certain amount of award of prejudgment interest from July 2019 until March 8th of 2022. That was when the court first, now we've got a final judgment and now let's calculate, prejudgment interest, which would be different than anything that would have been awarded back in 2019. So from that standpoint, I mean, there's no prejudice, and I don't believe the district court abused its discretion under Rule 60. 0.01 in awarding and correcting the record to reflect mandatory prejudgment interest. And I see I'm out of time.
Thank you. Mr. Giesen, any rebuttal?
I'd like to address briefly one point on the settlement issue and then one point on the interest issue. I think Mr. Johnson was arguing that the second and third sentences of paragraph B2 simply limit collection from assets other than the personal assets of Mr. Cruz and Mr. Gosch. But that's what sentence one in paragraph B2 does. To collapse sentences two and three into what sentence one says is also not a reasonable way to interpret this contract. So I think just look at this first sentence of paragraph B2, and that's the provision that says that my clients are never going to have to pay this judgment. The second and third sentences have to do with when the judgment against them is going to go away, when it's going to be satisfied, as called out in the title of this agreement. And that, I think, is the dispositive issue, is the timing of when this judgment has to go away. And that's different than simply limiting collection against their personal assets.
Go ahead. Ms. Orcutt agree to something like that? I mean, why is that a rational reading of this language, a reasonable reading of the language?
Well, I think that's what the language says. So I think the words themselves are the best evidence of intent. Personal motivations behind signing this language, I think, would be relevant if there was ambiguity. And that would be certainly something we'd be getting into in the event of a remand, if this court agrees with the district court that this language is ambiguous. So, you know, there's no record as to Ms. Orcutt's intent. Our position is, and apparently Ms. Orcutt's position is, that these subjective intent is not relevant. The language is clear. And obviously, we have starkly different interpretations of this language. But to the extent this subjective intent is going to be relevant, that needs to be done with fact finding.
My question on that point, Mr. Giesen, is this. If we were to accept that we should reverse and remand for fact finding, what additional record would you propose to make on remand regarding the issue that we don't have before us right now?
I think we had a footnote in our brief when we called out Mr. Johnson for not citing the whichever comes first language. Judge King asked him, you know, what do you make of that language? And he said, well, I'd have to ask the drafter. So that is a great example. You know, we talked to the drafter of this language. We need to create record. We need to have some probably limited discovery. Obviously, we didn't think we needed that because we think that the language speaks for itself. But in the alternative, that is, you know, we got to talk to the drafter and, you know, do the other kinds of fact finding and analysis that goes into resolving ambiguity in the contracts, all the surrounding circumstances, who the drafter of this agreement was, its contra profit rentum, various considerations. So, you know, that's not before the court right now, but certainly we would like to have that create a record on that. In the event
the reason I ask that is it looks to me from page 786 of the Drake Ryan case itself that the parties actually had agreed there that the defendants will have no personal liability, the effect of which would be to be a release of them individually. And nevertheless, the Supreme Court said you can proceed against the insurers, even though the defendants have already obtained a release that says they'll have no personal liability.
Yep. You know, I agree with that. And I think this release does say in that first sentence of B2 that they're not going to have personal liability. But then it goes on beyond that. And again, it calls for a satisfaction of judgment. So that's different than saying that you don't have any personal liability on the judgment. It also says this judgment docketed against you, this, you know, highly.
Where does it say that they have a satisfaction of judgment? I read it, the paragraph B2, as saying they have a discharge and release from any liability under a judgment, not satisfaction of that judgment.
And it is true. It says discharge. If you read paragraph 1 of B, it says satisfy any judgment. It's going to be partially satisfied with this payment. And if you look at the title, it says satisfaction of future judgment. So, you know, reading this language together, the discharge contemplated in the second and third sentences of paragraph B2 in peri materia, it's the same thing. And we've cited Blacks for that. It's the same thing as a satisfaction. If you discharge the judgment, it's satisfied. That's exactly what's been calling out in the title. Drake v. Ryan didn't address this issue. There is no analysis in that case whether a party may promise to satisfy a judgment by a date certain. That's the language in this contract, and we'd ask that court to enforce this particular language in this contract. And with that, we thank the court for its time.
Thank you. The case was well briefed and well argued. It's unfortunately, an interesting case. Second time is back to us, and we will have a decision out within the 90 days. Thank you again, counsel.
Thank you, judges.